surgical menopause. What if you have no ovaries? I'm Dr. Valerie Davidson from Progress Your Health.
And I'm Dr. Robert Mackey from Progress Your Health. So this one, we just received this question actually less than 24 hours ago. And in our community, we were just actually, we were talking about surgical menopause. We're doing two episodes sort of back to back. So what video was this comment from? I know you wrote it down.
Yeah. So this video was from our recent one. The video was called Hormone Dosing Explained, Minimum versus Optimal Levels. So somebody had mentioned that they wish that there was more discussion on surgical menopause. And like Dr. Mackey was saying in our Progress Your Hormones community, we were talking a little bit about when you have your ovaries out and how that's different than when you're going through just, you know, traditional menopause and the ovaries are starting to decline, or even perimenopause, that it's almost a little bit like apples and oranges when you're approaching someone looking at, they don't, you know, their ovaries were in and then they're out. So that was something that we had been talking about in our community. And then it was interesting because just a few hours later, after we had that live event, we get this question, which I think is wonderful, because I think in our Progress Your Health podcast here, we have neglected talking about surgical menopause, what that means and what you can do about that.
Sure, sure. And when you have a hysterectomy with the ovary removal, right, their symptom profile sort of it sort of shows up relatively quickly. I know you and I have discussed before women that have had hysterectomies where they leave the ovaries, hysterectomy where they take the ovaries, and it's quite a bit different in how they respond, whether the ovaries have been left or removed. Would you agree with that?
So maybe just to sort of back up a little bit. So surgical menopause is kind of what it sounds like, is you've had the removal of the ovary. So that's an oophorectomy. A lot of times when you're doing surgical menopause, they'll take the uterus out too. So sometimes you might call that a total hysterectomy. So you've removed the uterus, you've removed the ovaries. I have had certain cases where the ovaries were removed, but not the uterus. But I would say I can only count that maybe on one hand.
What would be a situation why they would do that?
I'm not sure.
Is that an oversight on the surgeon? Like, what would be the point of that?
You know, there's so many different reasons for taking out the ovaries, which right. I think we should go into next on why there is surgical menopause and sure. why that's happening. But I think maybe it could be an insurance thing. Somebody had, maybe there's a bunch of ovarian cysts or there's something going on with the ovaries. So the ovaries need to be removed, but the uterus doesn't need to be. Mm-hmm. But like I said, I've only seen a few cases of that. In most cases, if you're going to remove the ovaries, you'll see the uterus removed as well. Now, there are a lot of cases where women might have fibroids or have thickened endometrial lining, mm-hmm. and they don't need to remove the ovaries because maybe they're perhaps young, so they want to keep that ovarian function. So they just do a hysterectomy where they remove the uterus. Yeah. Now, like I said, that's a different story in terms of having surgical menopause where they go in and remove the ovaries on purpose.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know about the historical data. It seems like all the women that your mom and my mom's age, like from the 70s and 80s, maybe even the 60s, it's like they all had hysterectomies. My mom had a hysterectomy right after I was born at 28. It seems like back then they did total hysterectomies, where now it seems like if they're going to do a hysterectomy, they just remove the uterus and they leave the ovaries. Have you noticed the same?
Yeah, well, you think the ovaries are a super important endocrine gland. They're, they're secreting your estrogen and your progesterone. So if you're 30 years old and you're having your ovaries removed, that's a lot of years of not mm-hmm. having hormones in your system, as opposed to if you're 40 or if you're 50. So that historical stuff is kind of like a whole other genre that we could talk about on why that's happening. I think nowadays, you know, there's prophylactic for people that might have genetic risks for ovarian and breast cancer. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason why they might remove the ovaries. Just, maybe there's no issue going on there.
They're trying to prevent an issue.
Exactly. Because maybe they have the BRCA1 or they have, you know, the different genetic mutation, or I wouldn't even call them mutations. That's a weird word to use. I don't know if that's a good word to use. But, and, you know, there's some family genetics that's putting them more at risk than somebody else. So I can completely understand that rationale with that. Mm-hmm. And then there's other aspects where there could be cysts on the ovaries, there could be a problem with the ovaries. You know, there's reasons on why they would remove the ovaries. Now, like I was saying, not to get into the weeds, but it's a whole lot different when you remove the ovaries when you're in mid-30s, mid-40s, or early 50s,
yeah.
just because of right. that, you know, the ovarian
time,
function.
The time, yeah, yeah. Because most of the time when you get a hysterectomy, they leave the ovaries. I think the surgeon feels that they're doing the woman a favor by leaving the ovaries mm-hmm. because there's still some hormone production there. And that's where the variance happens. When they leave the ovaries, their symptoms might not show up for weeks, months, or sometimes even years. But what you're the distinction you're making when they remove the ovaries, they're going to get menopausal symptoms relatively quickly, right? Because their hormone function, there is no more hormone production whatsoever. The hormone levels are going, they're overnight, they're literally going into menopause.
Exactly. So you're maybe making, so let's say typically somebody in their early 40s, they're having their ovaries removed, even the mid 40s, because you're still making estrogen as you're going from making hormones to not making hormones.
Right.
Now, in a perfect world, our adrenal glands secrete DHEA, which that has its pathway to estrogen. It can convert into testosterone. Mm-hmm. DHEA can, pregnenolone can convert into progesterone. So there's, you know, ways that the adrenals are supposed to buffer that change. But really, when you're doing surgical menopause, you're going from hormones to no hormones.
Yeah, yeah.
And so what you want to think about is, like you're saying, I notice when a woman has had an oophorectomy or their ovaries are removed, that it takes a few weeks before they notice. I've never had a patient that I've talked to that had their ovaries removed and it took years for them to have
right,
symptoms.
Right.
I've had, usually it takes somewhere between 3 up to 6 weeks. They'll say, oh, I felt really good, nothing. And then all of a sudden the hot flashes are coming.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
that could be a little bit of the body's compensation for that. But I do find that when you're thinking of it, you're thinking of their acute symptoms, because you think about menopause. I mean, menopause symptoms are real, and there's yeah. lots of them. Can you imagine going from having ovarian function to none, so no hormones, so they can have a lot of acute symptoms? But then you're also thinking long term, is if somebody doesn't have that estrogen and that progesterone, what is that going to do, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the road for their bones, for their brain health, for their cardiovascular health?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And of course, timing would make a difference. So if you're in your late 30s, having a total hysterectomy is a big difference than your late 40s or even your, I mean, would you do a total hysterectomy? I guess you could if there was a problem in your early 50s.
I've had, I think I had a patient not too long ago, and she's a cyst former in general. That's mm-hmm. just her. She makes cysts and, she, you know,
PCOS cysts or
no,
just cysts
like,
in
No, more
like,
you know, like cysts on the skin. You know, some people are just cyst formers. They just mm-hmm. make cysts.
Yeah.
And then she made a pretty big cyst on that ovary that had been sitting there for a while. It wasn't changing, but, you know, her gynecologist was like, you know what, just take it out.
Yeah.
She's not doing anything
and,
anyway.
And how old was she at the time of the
her
procedure?
Mid-60s.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Mid-60s. There was a cyst.
But was it causing any pain or any issues, or are they just monitoring it with an ultrasound and they just decided just to do it?
Well, it's kind of it, when you don't know you have a cyst. Like, I've had ovarian cysts. I make cysts and whatnot, but I've had a couple before. When you don't know you have it, sometimes you don't feel it. So you think,
right.
oh, you know, I got a little hip flexor pain from doing some exercise, or maybe I got a little bowel issue. But then when you find out, oh, look, you've got a cyst on your left ovary,
mm-hmm.
then you're like, I can feel it.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
It's oh, I don't know yeah. if it's a brain
when,
thing.
Once you have the awareness
yeah,
of
so,
it. Yeah,
so
yeah.
when she knew, she had the awareness of it. And we were thinking, well, maybe that hip pain was really a little pinching of that ovaries. But a lot of times those cysts, you don't feel it unless
yeah,
it
right.
bursts. And holy moly, do you feel it. But the that's really
but
common.
But a 60-year-old woman isn't going to have a ruptured cyst necessarily because there's no more hormones there.
Which, you know, she may or may not. It depends. But you know but for her, that's not technically surgical menopause because she had went through menopause.
Right, right.
You know,
yeah,
10
she's
years.
Already postmenopausal.
Exactly.
At that point,
so she's not going from hormones to no hormones. Where other women, they might be younger and they need to have their ovaries out, and that could be from, like I said, a lot of different things. I find probably the top one is endometriosis.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that can be so incredibly painful, and they're going through multiple surgeries that finally it's like, you know, let's take these ovaries out. And then, you know, and that actually, honestly, I have a lot of patients that don't have their ovaries because of endometriosis, and
yeah.
they were quite young when they had those ovaries removed, that we do HRT, and it doesn't aggravate their endometriosis,
yeah.
but that's another side topic.
Yeah, I have a patient, she's in her early 40s, and endometriosis, just a miserable history for her of, you know, just painful periods, you know, the whole nine yards with endometriosis. And finally, she went to her surgeon who had done a surgery earlier when she was like in her 20s. and decided, her and I talked about it ahead of time before the surgery. I says, you should have a total hysterectomy. You should have your uterus and your ovaries removed. And all he did was remove the uterus. I said, that's sort of like a, in her specific case, it was sort of like the wrong thing to do. Removing her ovaries would probably given her more relief, right? Because now that hormone production is gone. But he thought he was doing her a favor by leaving the ovaries, and now she's sort of still in the same situation where she's still not, where if she just would have had the total, I think she would have been a little bit more comfortable and would have had less symptoms. She's better, right? There's not as that's much good. Hormone production. Yeah, she's good. Better, but I think it would have been, and at least in that particular situation, he thought he was doing her a favor, but hormonally, I don't think that it was doing her any favors.
Yeah, because sometimes when those hormones are erratic, for whatever reason, mm-hmm. is when you, like you said, you have the ovaries removed, then you have a little bit more control on how you're going to work the hormone replacement if you're going to do that. But every practitioner, every surgeon, everybody, like you said, that practitioner probably felt good about it because wanted to keep that hormonal production.
Yeah.
And then also too, just on a completely side note, there's also insurance says, okay, for this, we remove the uterus and then you pay for that. And then later, if there's still pain, then you remove the, insurance is kind of a racket too. So
sure.
There's so many different reasons for that.
I'm not sure how much she advocated for herself just because the surgeon has a plan and decides what they're going to do. I think in her specific case, she would have been better off just having a total hysterectomy. Just as I said, from a symptom standpoint. Where normally I think a woman leaving the ovaries, I think is actually most of the time is probably the right thing to do most of the time. Mm-hmm. But like I said, just like with everything, there's always, exceptions to the rule. There's always some sort of individualization to it that you have to sort of take into consideration. Okay, so let's just say, what would you, maybe this is a unfair question. Is there endometriosis probably is because you just said it. That's the most common reason maybe for a woman to go into surgery, to be put into surgical menopause from a total hysterectomy.
For that age, for that age range. And I think that's why, like I said, we've kind of neglected talking about surgical menopause when I do feel like it's really important. Sure, there's lots of different ways to treat endometriosis. Mm-hmm. And then the highest intervention is having a total hysterectomy.
Sure.
And some people have to go there. But that's the cool thing with the hormone replacement nowadays is now we have so many options for hormone replacement to be able to replace that. So somebody that's in their early 40s and they really need that hormone replacement, they're going from lots of hormones to no hormones. You can do higher doses. You can do the rhythmic doses, which mm-hmm. we've talked about, as opposed to somebody that, their ovarian function is starting to decline. They're going through perimenopause, in between peri and meno and then into menopause. And then, that's a little bit of a different situation.
Yeah, they go from a decade of having some hormones to having no hormones like overnight. That's going to be pretty dramatic transition. We like to use rhythmic dosing in those situations just because they're younger. Their body is used to having higher hormone levels, and especially if they have that estrogen dominant sort of profile of the endometriosis or really bad fibroids or something, their body sort of responds to higher estrogen, maybe not in a great way, and where too much of a good thing sort of becomes a problem, but they can handle they can handle a higher dosing with the rhythmic dosing as opposed to some of the other conventional options. And it's going to put them at a little bit more of a normal physiologic state of where they were prior to the hysterectomy.
Exactly. So, rhythmic dosing, you are mimicking the ovarian cycle. You're changing that estradiol levels throughout the 28-day cycle, and you're starting that progesterone on day 14, mm-hmm. changing those doses. It's not the same progesterone dose every day for 14 days. You're changing that progesterone dose to mimic the progesterone cycle in an ovarian cycle, in a 28-day cycle. Now, you'd have to do it as a 28-day cycle because somebody that doesn't have a uterus or the ovaries, they're not going to get a period. So like myself, I'm doing rhythmic dosing myself right mm-hmm. now, and I get a period, and I'm 52 years old. But that's because I have a uterus. But with a total hysterectomy and somebody that went through surgical menopause, they wouldn't get a period because they don't have that uterus, but you're still mimicking that ovarian cycle. And I feel like for that age, for a younger woman,
late 30s, early 40s.
Late 30s, early 40s, they really need physiological levels of estradiol.
Right.
If progesterone is fantastic, we love it, but the physiological levels of estradiol is going to protect her brain, protect her heart, protect her bones for the years coming down the road, as opposed to somebody that did go through menopause at 50, you know, I've had hormones up until I was 50, making them on my own. I did supplement with progesterone like we all do when we're in perimenopause, whole nother story. But somebody that had to go through no hormones starting at like 40, I've got 10 years on them. So that's where you're looking at that profile a little differently than somebody that hasn't gone through surgical menopause or even like somebody that went through menopause in their 40s. I've had lots of patients that have gone through their menopause in their early 40s, and I have to think of them differently than somebody that's going through menopause in their early 50s to mid 50s, because of the, you know, we want to reduce the risk of chronic disease. And I do feel like when estrogen drops, that increases your risk for heart disease, for diabetes, for
Alzheimer's.
Brain, dementia, all of it.
Osteoporosis, yeah. It seems like when we've been doing these podcasts, the things that women are concerned the most about are their bone and their brains. It seems like that comes up over and over. How do I protect the heart as well? But I think I don't think that's as much for a healthy woman in general that has a good lifestyle. I don't think the heart disease is as much as a risk for them as is the Alzheimer's and the osteoporosis.
But that is interesting because I have noticed when women go through menopause, their cholesterol goes up.
Yeah, right.
I used to think this was way back maybe a number of years, and there probably is a little bit of validity to that, is maybe that genetics is catching up with you. You have some family genetics for higher cholesterol. Maybe that's catching up with you once you hit menopause, but it really is when that estrogen declines, that LDL cholesterol can go up. So I do feel like there is, and not that cholesterol is a be-all end-all for heart disease. We both know that. That's just one little tiny little thing to look at. But it is one thing that you do notice. So you're right. A lot of women are like, what can I do to protect my bones? What can I do to protect my heart? And what can I do to protect my brain? Like, those are the three big ones. Now, there's also the acute issues that we can go through too. But I do feel like the rhythmic dosing is beneficial on that. But not everybody can tolerate it. And it's not for everyone. Because I have had some women that have had total hysterectomies, ovaries taken out in their, you know, mid-30s, late-30s, and they can't tolerate the rhythmic dosing. Everyone is different. And so then maybe we might do static dosing. And there's so many hormones are super important. I love the hormones. But there's also things we can do to protect our heart, you know, with exercise or diet and lifestyle and supplementation. So we're looking at it from that full vantage point.
Well, let's be honest. The hormones are not going to correct a poor lifestyle. Right. The lifestyle has to be there first, diet, exercise, all those things, good sleep. The hormones are an accoutrement or almost like an adjunct therapy to those things. Now, the surgical menopause, though, that is sort of a different category. If you castrated a man in his 30s, right? I mean, that's essentially what a hysterectomy is. You're castrating a woman.
It would be melee.
Yeah, yeah.
That would never happen.
It would never happen. I mean.
Not prophylactically.
Yeah, no, not done on accident necessarily or on purpose necessarily, unless it was some kind of torture or something. So we look at it as being just a simple thing you can take out for a woman. But it is quite a bit different, though. Women are going to get to the point where they're in menopause, where they're not producing any more hormone. Men are a little bit different in that respect. So you can't do it necessarily to men, even though we do it to our animals, all the time. I think that's sort of changing a little bit too. I think it's just one of those things on the animal side. You spay and neuter, which I think is good to control population. But if you're a responsible pet owner, there's longevity issues for animals when you spay and neuter them. Their lifespan is reduced. So why wouldn't the same thing happen for humans if those things were happening to us? Obviously, it's quite a bit. It's not comparing apples to apples. A male's aging pattern versus a female's aging pattern, I think females are at a disadvantage. The surgical menopause really puts them hormonally at a big disadvantage, just like you said, because of the timing factor.
Yeah, one thing that is, I will say, when you're working with a woman that has a uterus and you're doing static dosing, you want to be really careful that that estradiol isn't having any effects on that estrogen-sensitive tissue, like the ovaries, like the uterine lining in particular, where they're getting you know, a thickened uterine lining, they're getting irregular bleeding, then they have to have a biopsy. The breast tissue, there's increased breast density, there's increased fibrocystic tissue. So you have to be really careful with that estradiol level. But at the same time, somebody in surgical menopause is going to be more receptive to more estradiol because they're going from having hormones to none. Their body is missing that.
And their body wants the more estrogen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it almost needs it. Yeah.
And they don't have a uterus, so you don't have to worry about that hyperproliferation of the uterine lining, which could put them at risk for uterine cancer. So that is one thing about having the uterus out with a total hysterectomy, with the ovaries out, that you're pretty much, you don't have to worry about uterine cancer.
Well, and two things. So you don't have to worry about the uterine cancer, which is, if for hormone replacement, that's the big risk, right? Breast cancer, very complex, not driven by hormones or not caused by hormones. Estrogen specifically, but uterine cancer with hormones is what every hormone doctor is trying to prevent for the most part. When it's done properly, it's really not an issue. However, if you're in surgical menopause, you've had a total hysterectomy, rhythmic dosing raises your hormone levels, but now you don't have to deal with the inconvenience of having a period every month, because there's a lot of women don't want to do rhythmic dosing because they have to have a period. But if you've had a hysterectomy, then you're sort of in the clear. Now it just comes down to your cycle's 28 days every month. And now symptomology, you know, your subjective response of the patient and the lab work are your guides to be able to make appropriate adjustments, where the period becomes, and when a woman is having a period on rhythmic dosing, you're getting a very good landmark, so to speak, of the event of the period, mm-hmm. because it tells you a lot of information. Is the period smooth and simple? Is it heavy and clotty? Is it showing up on time? Is it showing up late? All that information tells you on how those hormones need to be manipulated on our level, right? So we know how to tweak it. So now that if they are having a cycle, you can make it as smooth and easy as possible every single month. When they don't have a cycle, now that information that you're inferring from them, from feedback, is sort of taken away. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. No, if you're on the rhythmic dosing, we don't want anybody to have a yucky period. We want it easy peasy, like a nice balanced period, because that's for the protection of the uterine lining. Now,
and for their sanity too. I mean, no one wants to have
a heavy period.
You know, the ones that I've noticed too, not to cut you off, the ones that I've noticed that are a little bit hesitant of going into rhythmic dosing are the ones that had troubled periods in the past. Right, the worse their menstrual history, the less excited they are about having a period in their 50s. They sort of want the break, like they're sort of glad it's over. Now, granted, even in those troubled cases, you know, like in your case, endometriosis, on paper, you really shouldn't be a good candidate for rhythmic dosing because of your kind of tumultuous menstrual history. Would you agree?
Well, that's the thing with endometriosis. It's not just about the estrogen. It's not just about, you know, it's about that whole pelvic microbiome, reducing down inflammatory factors. So whenever we're working with anybody with endometriosis, or they've had a past history of endometriosis and we're going to do HRT, mm-hmm. we also want to work on some of those other pathways of reducing down inflammation that they may have been subject to, because that's their personal biome or whatnot. So there's so many other caveats.
Yeah, genetics, liver, and liver detoxification, a lot of things are playing. Stress level.
Or even before they were to have a total hysterectomy, you know, with the oophorectomy, there's lots of things we can do to work on endometriosis. I mean, that is one thing. And then by being able to have control of the hormones, because we love the ovaries, our hormones are the best hormones in the world, but they can be like little gremlins and you can't control them. Without the ovaries, you have a little bit more control on how you're going to be able to develop that HRT.
Especially with the rhythmic dosing. It gives you a lot of control that way. Where the static dosing, the patch, you know, you don't get as much control that way. With the rhythmic dosing, you almost have full control.
But with static dosing, we have lots of control with the static dosing.
Well, I just meant from a dosing level, right? From a dosing level. Static dosing, you're only be able to achieve so much. With rhythmic dosing, you're gonna have that rise and fall, right? You're gonna have the ups and downs of the estrogen and progesterone, the way that, at least trying to copy as best we can, the way Mother Nature sort of intended it.
And I would say also with somebody that's had, you know, so we're talking about a uterus now. Somebody with having surgical menopause, they don't have a uterus. One thing that I think is really pivotal is, of course, getting their subjective information and how they're doing, family history, family health, is looking at their blood work, and not just at that estrogen and progesterone. We're going to look at that adrenal blood work. And you think about, they're going through surgical menopause early in, you know, might be in their mid-30s, might be in their mid-40s, mm-hmm. is looking at those cholesterol levels. I'll even say, I know you're supposed to, you know, they give DEXA scans at 50. Like, if you had surgical menopause, let's do a DEXA scan now. Let's see what your bone density is right now so we can see what it is in 2 years to make sure that we're maintaining that bone density.
Well, see, now that's going back to the insurance issue, right? They wait and wait and wait and wait to do DEXA scans. Why wouldn't you do a DEXA scan when a woman's 25? 25, 30, 35, 40.
Because it'll be zero. 40. It'll be like perfect. No well, bone density loss at all.
Well, maybe not. I mean, maybe not. Maybe it wouldn't be as perfect as we would think it would be perfect, but maybe it wouldn't be perfect. Now, granted, the statistically speaking, it probably would be good for a good majority of them, but you would be able to see how that bone density starts to change over time as opposed to waiting until they have no hormones left. Of course it's going to change then. Right.
But that's interesting. Yeah, if somebody maybe had stress fractures on their feet, if they're a runner, or if their parent mom had osteoporosis, you're right. That would be much better.
Well, especially now with all the GLP-1 usage, I think that doing them earlier is a good idea.
They're not. I know that, you know, we have, like, there's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, which is in October. So I remember people would just go and pay cash for a mammogram. They're actually sure. A lot of radiology places will give you a huge break on that, like $100 or something. I know that bone density awareness month. I want to say it's May, but I know that a lot of radiology departments, you can just go in there and pay cash.
Oh yeah,
and
yeah.
It's not a lot. You know, no, it's not thousands of dollars like an MRI or something.
No. Yeah.
Where you can
DEXA scans are relative. I mean, you can do one for body composition, body fat percentage. That it's the same machine that does body fat percentage. DEXA is the same thing that does bone density. In some ways, you could do them both at the same time. If you're trying to burn fat. Because you're working out and doing all those things, you get a bone density, lean muscle mass plus your bone, you're getting two pieces of information at the same time. Again, with the GLP usage and things like that, I think those are wonderful ideas that should be, I guess what I'm trying to say is that people shouldn't necessarily wait for their insurance to pay for everything.
They're going to pay for
as little as possible, where these things could be implemented and relatively at pretty reasonable costs. And now you have a full array of information over a woman's lifetime, as opposed to waiting when the problems start to show up, which is what insurance does. It kind of passes the buck down the path a little bit, and now you're trying to fix problems when they could have been prevented a long time ago. There's a different mindset there on how medicine approaches it and how people approach it. Just a little tangent.
Yeah, so I guess to make a short story long.
Yeah.
So if you've had surgical menopause, then I always recommend, hey, let's do a DEXA scan now.
Sure.
Let's see where you're at.
Absolutely.
Because you're right. The rhythmic dosing is awesome for somebody that's gone through surgical menopause, but it's not awesome for everybody. So yeah. there's gonna be other options, for people that they're going to have to do. So that's where maybe if they're doing the static dosing, you can keep the estradiol a little higher because they don't have that uterus anymore. You still need to take progesterone if you don't have your uterus. That's probably a big one we should talk about.
Yep.
Still want to take that progesterone.
A lot of gynecologists say that you don't have to take progesterone.
I think they're changing their bent now. I know that was a huge thing like 10 years ago that
I think forever.
Yeah, I would have arguments almost, not rude arguments or anything, but just kind of discussions on, no, you need to take your progesterone. Yes, yeah. They need to take their progesterone. So I do feel like that's important. So somebody with surgical menopause, and I kind of feel like this with all our HRT patients and all our, women's longevity and women's health, we need to work closely together. It's not here's something, go on your way and I'll see you in a year.
That does not work with hormones. I mean, I know that it does with blood pressure and cholesterol and all the medications that everybody takes. You take your pill and, whatever. Hormones, it's just not that way. It's just there's always sort of constant tweaking and adjustments and things that need to be done because you're doing something that literally the body did for, 20, 30, 40 years, and then now you're trying to replicate that in whatever capacity that is. It's not an exact science. There's no one way to do it. There's no perfect way to do it. A woman's body is, women are the same species, but every woman's different. Therefore, the way she's going to respond to those hormones, every woman's different. So it is a, it's complicated, but at the same time, we end up been doing this for a long time. Women want to feel as good as they can feel. And it is sort of shocking to me how little emphasis is put on hormones help us the way we look and feel on a day by day basis. It's amazing how that gets just brushed to the side, and it has no impact on, you know, on our health on a day by day basis, except for when a woman's in menopause.
Yeah, because that does bring us back to, you know, I'm talking about bones and heart and health and preventative. We're thinking about somebody that went from hormones to no hormones. They're, you know, somewhere around that 3 to 6 weeks, maybe 8 week mark. They're going to get a lot of hot flashes. They're going to get a lot of brain fog.
They're going to be miserable.
They're going to not be able to sleep. They're going to have a lot of mood issues.
And they're working. They're working. They're taking care of the children. They're doing all these things. They have, you know, normal everyday stressors, you know, life stressors. But trying to do that when you're dealing with all those physical symptoms, that's not, you know, that's not a really a fun proposition. I mean, now granted, you're having the hysterectomy or the total hysterectomy. There's a reason why you're at that spot. And I don't blame any woman, right? Because endometriosis is a stubborn problem to solve. There's no, even you and I being hormone doctors, endometriosis is one of those ones that sometimes you just can't figure it out. You can't, you know, you can't get them to the place where they're comfortable and have no pain, have no discomfort, have no heavy bleeding, whatever the case might be. And that might be just the best option for them because they've exhausted. And most of them that we've seen over the years, they have exhausted all those options. And they're finally at that point. Speaking about my patient specifically, I think she had her surgery probably a year ago or maybe 6 months ago, end of last year or something. I know, I think it might have been the beginning of this year, where she was just at that point where she was just sort of done and over it. It's like, okay, let's just be done.
You know, yeah, and they're so happy. They're so happy. Yeah. The pain is gone.
The relief.
Yeah. It's better. And then you can, you know, once they start to get the low hormone symptoms or maybe mm-hmm. a little vaginal dryness or, you know, like I said, the mood issues or a little brain fog or, you know, a little weight gain. There's so many things we can do acutely with that, with the HRT. So that's why the HRT is so cool.
Yeah. All right. So I think we've talked enough about, at least for now, enough about surgical menopause. Do you have any final closing comments about that issue?
I'm sure that there's more. And so I'm going to write a message to the person that asked this question on our YouTube channel and ask if there was any other concerns around that, because I'm sure there's tons more we could talk about. But I'm sorry we neglected talking about surgical menopause, because I realize we haven't really spent a lot of time on that, and I probably should do that, because that is, you know, that is a common
thing. It's just another subset, and it happens probably you know, hundreds of thousands of times on an annual basis, you know, over the course of a year, that there's probably a big segment of women out there that are in that situation. And honestly, you know, you're a surgeon. This is nothing against gynecologists. Gynecologists are surgeons. They're not always necessarily, they're good surgeons. You want the best surgeon, obviously, but they might not necessarily have all the best options for the hormone side once the surgery's over. So definitely we'll be, kind of exploring that topic. So interesting. So surgical menopause, early menopause, the other thing that has come up a few times, premature ovarian insufficiency, right? So all this, early menopause stuff for women at, you know, late 30s, early 40s, where you typically wouldn't expect to see that stuff. They're all kind of in a similar little bucket there. So we'll definitely be touching on those topics in the future. Again, any last final comments? Are we good for now?
Nope. I think this is great.
Yeah. So if you have any questions, you can either go to our website, Ask the Doctor, Progress Your Health, click on the tab at the top, Ask the Doctor, put in your name and email, or you can just write a comment on YouTube down below. And we get lots of questions, so we try to get to as many as we can. Compliments always help to, you know, get your name up there. Honestly, I'm a little nervous about YouTube, but honestly, for the most part, everyone has been very, very nice and appreciative of our channel and the content we're putting out. So that's a little bit of a relief, right? We haven't gotten too many haters yet or people making, you know, mean comments. That's been really nice. So again, comment down below. Until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Valerie.
Take care. Bye-bye.